Alrighty, team. Patty, quick sound check. I'll unmute you there. Patty Upton, how are you going?
Yeah, very good. How are you doing, Grant?
Lucker, man. Well, sorry, that was a mix up with the meeting rooms there. I've started recording already. And if I can just say, guys, can you please make sure, with the exception of Patty, everyone's got their mics on mute, and I think we've done that. Remember everything. Anytime you want to ask Patty a question, please feel free to use the chat option. There will be, I'll read those. If you message me privately, I will ask the question just as if it's from myself. And if you message to everyone, I'll use your name. And we still got guests coming in, so that's awesome to see. And guys, please don't forget that we've had some great chats on here. Jeremy Shepherd's was an outstanding one. Andrew Russell with four AFL premierships, got some interesting stuff there. And Daniel Cooper talking about his military background and how he applied a lot of those lessons in Super Rugby. If you are on social media, please just give us Patty, is Patty Upton one, at Patty Upton one on Twitter. And give a little screenshot or shout out. That would be awesome. Or Propel Perform, PROPELPerform.com. What else? Yeah, and then at the end, guys, we might just take mics off mute and have some questions there. So feel free to record. Patty, thank you very much for your time. Welcome to the chat.
Yeah, morning. Thanks very much for having me. Well, morning here in South Africa. I'm not sure what time it is for your listeners around the world, but yeah, good to be here.
Well, Australia's East Coast, we just ticked past 7:30 p.m. and we are ready for this. Now, Patty, there's a couple of things we can talk about here. We have a very few number of directions and a number of tangents we can explore. Are you good? We start off 1994. You start working with the South African cricket team.
Yeah, happy to start there if I can remember that far back.
Okay, so Patty, one of the things that I'm really keen to explore in this chat is you started off strength and conditioning. If I remember correctly, you are a biokineticist, which is what I studied in Australia, and I think in the US it's called exercise physiology, or some countries it's called kinesiology. Strength and conditioning coaches typically start off with the physical side, and now you seem to really be embracing the mental side of things. Tell me a bit about that journey from those early cricket days to working with Western Province Rugby, and how you kind of evolved to be more mental.
If I go back to, as you said, 94, I was at that time having a full-time fitness trainer, or even a fitness trainer in professional cricket, didn't exist. There was no professional or state or provincial cricket team in the world that had a fitness trainer. Back then, I mean, Bob Woolmer was the coach of the South African team. And back then you had a coach, a physiotherapist, and a manager in international cricket teams. So I was actually the first fitness trainer to come on board full time. Was sort of between Bob Woolmer and Hansie Crinier. They decided that fitness was important enough to have somebody dedicated to do that role. One, Hansie was very fitness oriented, and Bob preferred to spend his time at the buffet table. And after 4 years of that, and then I moved over to work in rugby. And to me, it just felt so limiting, in that the players who believed in fitness training would do it anyway. And so on the one hand, those guys were really easy to work with. And there was probably more people who were on the other side who didn't believe in fitness training or associated extra fitness training with punishment. And particularly in South Africa, we had compulsory conscription into the military. And the way that people were punished in the military was to do exercise. And same at school, punishment at school was meted out by making people do exercise. I remember as a rugby team, every time we played badly, we knew Monday was going to be a serious running and push-up and sit-up session. So I was constantly working against attitudes that fitness is not necessary or not good or is a form of punishment, which really alerted me to the importance of actually working with attitudes towards fitness rather than fitness itself. And once I got attitudes right, fitness was very, very easy. You know, people just, they wanted to know what to do. They were sponges. They just did whatever was suggested. So I was actually ended up, even though I was a fitness trainer, right in those early days, probably worked more with trying to shift attitudes than make bodies fit. But also realized that that was such a limited view for me personally on preparing athletes for performance. So I got interested in actually having a much broader perspective of preparing athletes, sort of almost on a whole round. And I've always tended to be a big picture kind of thinker, and fitness or the S&C was too narrow a focus for my preferences at the time.
And then, okay, so you're exploring this, you're noticing that, if I change the attitude, I get better buy-in, which actually probably improves my fitness and improves my results by doing so. What were your early influences in terms of, resources or authors or people that you're kind of exploring this with, or was this kind of just self-discovery and iterate feedback, creating little loops like that?
In terms of S&C, there was no S&C books or any materials out at the time in the mid-90s around certainly training cricket, rugby, football. There was hardly anything around at the time. And it was more my personal experience of having finished 5 years of full-time fitness training and been lucky to work at certainly the top of the international game into when it came to cricket, and Western Province was probably the top rugby province or state at the time. And for me, I touched the emptiness of, at a young age, of working in those high-profile environments, working with high-profile people. And it sort of came to me in later years that I was working with people who had a special talent. And the confusion is people would treat them as special people. And a lot of them would actually conduct themselves and behave as if they were special people, as opposed to ordinary people with a special talent. And I didn't realize that until a bit later, but there was that disconnect with a lot of these people, there's much more of a sense of entitlement and self-value to them in the public space than actually when I got to know them on a one-on-one basis. And that got me to start asking questions of myself, how am I showing up in the world? And when I walked away from fitness training, S&C, after 5 years, I actually spent 6 months traveling around Southeast Asia on a very, very small budget, with a backpack on my back and barefoot. And it was during that time that I realized that I'd been caught up in the world of celebritydom, the world of ego, the world of looking good, that sort of false world of, because we were being treated as special people, we thought we were special. Because in the backpacker's world in Vietnam and Laos, nobody knows cricket. Nobody was interested in the fact that I had a string of degrees. That was just, if I was a good bloke, then I would get on well with people and be accepted. And if I was someone who thought I was important but not a good bloke, well, then I wouldn't be accepted in that anonymous world of the backpacker. And that's really, for me, where I realized the importance of being an all-around good human being is actually separate to being a great athlete or cricket player, rugby player, or golf or something like that. And to start integrating who players were being with what they were doing out there. And that, through a course of a few years of bumbling around trying to figure out what it is that I was looking for. And it was sort of in the early 2000s when I came across business coaching as a profession that I realized this is where all of those things came together, where I was coaching an all-round human being who happened to also be a good businessman or athlete.
Okay, so tell me, high performance sport, and especially in those days, talking your rugby, late 90s, early 2000s, if most people had that opportunity working with, rugby teams and cricket teams at the international level, they wouldn't have stepped off that treadmill to go and sort of find themselves and find their calling. What were some of the key decisions where you thought, I'm going to give this up, which is, we know that it's connections and it's momentum. And if you work with this job, then you can get the next one. If you get off that, you could just be bypassed for a long time. So what were some of those thoughts that you thinking, wait a second, I am going to get off this and I'm going to go find myself, or whatever the term might be?
So for me, the real turning point came when I touched the emptiness of that existence. I was meeting the Queen and Nelson Mandela and, you know, dining in the best restaurants and, you know, the top cities around the world and hanging with these so-called superstars and getting tickets to the Golden Circle and all the big movie concerts. So it really was the metaphorical high life. And I guess I don't know what I expected to the experience would be of that life. But when I got back to my hotel room at night and it was just me and nobody looking in, I got to touch the emptiness. It wasn't this wonderful experience that it was cracked up to be. Out there it was, but inside, when I started touching that emptiness and that loneliness, I started looking around at players and having conversations. And it emerged with quite a few players also, while they looked good in the limelight, when they got back into their room and they, you know, out of the public eye, and they took their fancy watch off and they took their South African cricket clothing off and they stood in their underwear in front of the mirror, like, who was the person who was actually looking back at them when all that was stripped away from them? And I guess that's what I touched. So when I just knew, I guess in a way I consider myself, I was lucky that I had the courage to go, I don't want this. It's really nice, but if I were to project this for the next 20 years of my life, it would feel really empty, and I might have some trophies in the cabinet, but will I feel really satisfied, deeply satisfied, if I die and I've just got a bunch of trophies in the cabinet? And the answer to me was no. So I left because I knew it wasn't what I wanted, but I had no idea what it was that I wanted. Mm-hmm. But I knew I needed to go first to create that space before maybe the answer would emerge and maybe not. I didn't really know, but I was just deeply moved to move on and out of that environment.
And then, okay, so that's awesome, because I think there's a deep reflection. And it's interesting, on a much smaller scale, I've gone through a similar thing where I've been at Wimbledon and eating at these fancy restaurants and stuff. But when the player that you're traveling with drops in rankings, well, then you're eating at different restaurants. So it had nothing to do with me per se. And if they went up in ranking, we had better restaurants. But there was that. And the way people treated you, depending on whether you're traveling with a seated player or a non-seated player, was totally different. In terms of transport to and from the hotel and all that kind of stuff. So I totally get that. What I'm interested then is, you've come back and you're a little bit clearer and you know what you're doing. And I'm guessing the second time around that you're working in this performance arena, you're a little clearer on who you are and what you want to offer.
Yes. I think the big realization that came to me a few months after leaving as an SNC, and I remember exactly where I was. I was in Vietnam. In those days, you had internet cafes. And I remember that I realized the emptiness that I touched was, I was wallowing in the playground of the ego. It was all about looking good, being around the right people, being seen to be smiley and happy and doing really well in life, and really playing that game. And I got caught up in playing that game in the world of looking good through the eyes of other people. And that was what the emptiness was, that I only realized much later, that I was living my life through the eyes of other people. And through the eyes of other people, I was 25 years old, traveling the world as world's first fitness trainer with these superstar cricketers, meeting other superstar cricketers. And it looked good, but it didn't feel for me as good as it looked.
Yeah.
So when I came back, I had much better, and I had no idea back then of the concept of ego and that I'd actually even got caught up in it. It was just actually, that was me. And it was only when I was able to separate myself and my ego and see how it was playing out, that when I came back into the professional sports world as a mental coach and then as a head coach, I was really able to see my ego and how it was wanting to play out and wanting to jump into conversations and wanting to, when I stood in front of a room of athletes to lead them, I could see how my ego would want to be speaking and want to look good and make things, you know, ego is just when we make things about me and looking good. So at least I could see my ego and constantly need to separate out. And it led to, and I'm probably jumping the gun here, but it's really relevant and I'll say it again later, is I think as a coach in any shape or form, our single biggest obstacle to our effectiveness is our own ego. Mm-hmm. And there's no bigger obstacle than our own ego. And if we don't really, I would say for any coach, the more we understand our ego, the more we can transcend it or operate separately to our ego, the more effective we are. And the less we do that, we might be good and look good for a little while, but as soon as our team drops in the rankings or that, ego will really take a big hit and it just does not work. It's not sustainable.
I can see how that happens, but to me, it's an interesting one because it's so tough because especially the head coach is put on a pedestal, you know, everything from the signing up of the first time the coach signs up and is introduced to the press, the entire time there would be a massive inner battle between just being surrounded by people who want to bow down to you and build your ego up, and you having to do you reject it or do you acknowledge it, accept it, and then sort of what's the strategy there?
I mean, let's just take a step to the left here. The spiritual people in this world, the meditators and the yogis and the spiritual teachers, they spend an entire lifetime working hours and hours every day to try and transcend their ego. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them still don't manage it. So it's not as simple as see my ego and put it aside. Yep. It's easy to say, but damn difficult to do. But for me, if I were to boil it down for me personally, my role as a coach is to genuinely serve the player's best interests. It's to serve their growth needs, their development needs, to serve their experience. And the only way I can serve their experience is to really understand what it is that they're wanting to get out of their time under me as coach. So when I'm genuinely focused on the player's best interest, I'm asking them questions, I'm really listening, what is their best interest? And then I serve that best interest. I'm making it all about the player. That's a player-centric approach. That's a servant leadership approach. That's where we are most effective, when it's about you and serving your needs. Conversely, ego says, I know what you need. I believe you might know what you need, but as coach, I know what you need. And let me tell you what you need to do. And when the media comes and talks to me, I make it about me and my ideas and my expertise and how flippin' good I am and all this crazy, all this good stuff that I do to make this team win. That's all ego when it's about me and my ideas and my thoughts and me being in the media. And even, yes, as head coaches, we're in the media a lot. But having tripped over my ego so many times, I know when I'm thinking about myself and I'm placing myself at front and center of answering the question, or am I thinking about the players when I'm asked the question, even if it's about me, I get the players at front and center and I answer the question, and it's all around serving the player's best interests and the best needs. And if we're in that space, serving the other, we will be maximally effective. And if we're in the space of serving myself and needing to be the person that seemed to be important and seemed to have all the answers, and which is what the old school coaching was all about, was the coach being the expert and telling people what to do. Mm-hmm. That's the antithesis of my approach. So that's sort of a bit mumble jumble, but that's sort of, if I were to boil down what is ego, it's having me at front and center and my ideas versus having the player's best interests and really being able to step outside ourselves to really hear what's going on for our players and to meet their needs. then we're not an ego and we're serving others. Egos like me, putting ego aside, we are easily able to serve other people.
So, I mean, I'm generalizing here, but what you're saying to me is almost like an argument against former athletes becoming coaches. And not that you're saying that, but as an athlete, when there is a lot of ego, they have to be front and center. It's their career. And so to transition from that, it's a 180. You know, for most people, they would say, former athlete, let's pick him. He's been there. He's been at the top. He can be the coach. But listening to what you're saying, that would be the hardest transition for many athletes to take it from about me, coach, I expect you to be thinking about me, and then changing that to be able to say, I'm thinking about someone else.
Yeah, that's a very, very valid point. It takes me back, Gary Kirsten, you know, he played 101 test matches, cricket test matches for South Africa. Over a period of a couple of years, he transitioned to coach, and his first ever coaching assignment was the head coach of the Indian national cricket team,
Yes. Which
is the big brand in world sport.
And sorry, Patty, just to hold on there, did you have a special relationship with Gary when you were with your South African cricket team? Was there like a bond that was maybe stronger than others?
Yes, so Gary and I used to get pissed together when we were at school. I mean, it's a technical term, that.
Yep.
And we played cricket together in the same team. When I was the fitness trainer in the 1990s, Gary was a player, so I worked as his fitness trainer. When he was a player later on in his career, I came back and I worked with him as a mental coach. So I had a friendship and had a number of different working roles with Gary. So yes, we had a very deep understanding of the way each other worked. We'd actually been in business together. We'd run a lot of workshops together. So we already had that really tight bond and deep understanding of each other's way of operating. But Gary said, this probably the single most difficult thing about transitioning from player to coach was going from being so focused on himself and his game to doing that 180 degree that you talk about to be focused on the players. Now, having been around and worked with quite a few coaches in my different coaching roles who were recent ex-players, those who were very egocentric and lacked awareness or what else, like a depth of awareness of who they're being as a person, tend to go on to be that egocentric, it's about me, I know what to do, just listen to me, I'm the expert, and you guys, your job's to follow my wisdom and expertise. That egocentric coach player becomes an egocentric coach. There are others, however, who have an emotional awareness, an emotional maturity, a depth of awareness to realize, I know what, when my coach spoke to me like that and gave me instruction or told me what to do or spoke down on me, or as if they were the expert and I was the person who needed to listen to them, I remember what that felt like for me, and I'm not going to do that to other players. And, you know, Gary Kirsten managed to do that. And he would talk about, you know, when I'm coaching, I need to take my coach cap off and put my player's cap as if I was the person receiving my communication. What would I like to receive? Because a lot of players played under those kind of coaches that they really didn't necessarily agree with the way that they were going about, particularly the instruction-based coaches. Mm-hmm. A guy like Rahul Dravid, he's a very humble person, so he's able to make the transition from player to coach because it's the humility that really set up his amazing ability to be a great coach. You know, I've worked with a guy like Mike Hussey. Mike Hussey, Australian cricketer, his natural humility enabled him to transition quite easily into a coaching role because he approaches it from a place of humility that I'm not the all-knowing expert who needs to impose on you. I'm humble enough to listen and to learn. So the more humble player or the more emotionally intelligent player makes, in my mind, a better modern-day coach. The more egotistical player makes a good old-school coach, the command and control bloke.
Yep. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Now, but there's also like a bit of a balance there, because for you and Gary, and the results are there, so I trust that. But to be almost egoless in your dealings with players, but you'd need a certain amount of ego to say, hands up, India, pick a novice coach, first time gig, and myself, and we can take this. So do you find that you can switch between almost being egocentric and egoless? Like, is that the... I'm just thinking like an interview board would want someone with confidence. It actually being egoless or low in ego might work against you in the interviewing process.
So being egoless is not lacking confidence.
Yep.
Ego is overconfident. That can spill over into an arrogance and is very scared to say, I don't know, I'm not sure. So yep. Ego is terrified of vulnerability and won't show it.
Yep.
Lacking ego, you have a full confidence in this is what I know, this is what I'm good at. But I also know if I step out of ego that I don't know everything and I'm not the best in this game, but I know a lot and I have a lot of experience, but there's a lot I don't know.
Yep.
And confidence is being confident in what I know and being okay not knowing what I don't know. Being okay to say, well, I'm actually not sure. There's somebody else who knows better. So let's go and find that person and find out who knows best.
Mm-hmm. And Patty, do you feel that there would be some, interview boards or something that would push back against that or not respect that? Like, do you feel like your personality has to fit the organization and be backed by that type of person?
So if I were to take the sort of the way coaching is transitioned, and at a very high level, it went from 20 years ago, the leader was the content expert. Mm-hmm. And their job was to tell people what to do because of their superior expertise, which gave birth to the command and control, authoritarian, top-down coaching approach or leadership approach. That's fundamentally changed today through the advent of the internet, where it is no longer possible to be the all-knowing expert anymore because of the amount of information that's available to everybody. So instead of 20 years ago, it was you impose your knowledge on people. Today, we need to extract the best knowledge out there, let that land on the table, and as a unit, we need to figure out together what is best. Mm-hmm. So that's the collective intelligence versus the all-knowing intelligence models. Now, depending on where, and each of us have, you know, different set points of operating, I'm very much in harnessing the collective intelligence. And I need to be, because I don't know enough about cricket actually to be a head coach of the T20 cricket teams that I've been coaching. I couldn't use the command and control approach because I'm not an expert enough. So I have had jobs where my approach hasn't lined up with the owners of that particular franchise and hasn't lined up with some of the other coaches. And I've came to experience that if my approach is going to work, I need to have buy-in all around. Mm-hmm. That we're going to be allowed to harness the collective intelligence of the players. We're going to allow the players to behave and assume the role of adults more so than in other environments. And that it's going to take time to figure out this new way of operating that is almost always superior to the other old school model where there is only one or two, three sources of intelligence within a team that's being imposed. This way takes a little bit longer, mainly because people aren't used to it. Most athletes are still used to, and they quite like being told what to do because it absolves them of any responsibility. Things go wrong, well, it's a coach told us, it's the coach's fault. I first understand what is the leadership approach, what is the owner's approach, what is the board approach. And when I understand that, I've said no to going to more interviews than what I've said yes to, because I realize there's just a misfit and it's going to be a waste of their time, my time, and a waste of their money. It's not going to work. So go and find the old school command and control approach, because that seems to be the culture, the system within which you're operating. So I think it's important for coaches to understand what is your approach that plays most into your strengths. And if you can find a team or organization where there's a really good fit, it gives you the best possible chance to play to your strengths and therefore to be successful.
All right, guys, I'm just going to hold there. So if anyone wants to flick through a chat question, the chat option is there. So please don't forget to do that. Now, okay, so Paddy, tell us about the I'm really interested in, because India, I'm guessing, was your first position where you could really sink your teeth into some thoughts that have been probably floating around in your mind, some thoughts that you've been working on, and maybe on a smaller scale with some business people. Tell us about how you changed that team to say, hey guys, this is the way to go. I'm going to actually coach, I'm guessing, very differently to how you've been used to it. And did you, you know, you mentioned earlier that there are some players that, you know, want to be absolved of ownership. But I'm interested in those first few months or as those cogs are turning, and you're probably shining some light into some dark areas and getting some cogs to turn that haven't been turning in the player's probably entire career.
So, Grant, I would say there was quite a lot of luck and timing involved. In the lucky things that we inherited was, number one, we inherited a really talented team of cricketers. Although their test ratio, their 50% win ratio in test cricket and 30% win ratio in one day internationals, which was very low for the talent of that team. So we were lucky that we inherited good players. Number two, we inherited an unhappy team, and they were unhappy primarily because their coach of the previous 18 months was a very authoritarian command and control type individual who was a foreigner who went to India and said, this is what you need to do and how you need to do it.
And sorry, were you aware of that? Were you aware of that before you took that on, that they were unhappy?
We did a lot of research, yes. We had one-on-one interviews with all the players.
Okay, all right, cool.
So we were coming off the back of knowing that as a foreigner, don't come in here and impose our way and our will on the players. It's not going to work. So we were lucky there was another baseline that we came into. And the other thing is, it was Gary's first role as a coach in his coaching life. He hadn't even coached his son's under nine team at school.
And sorry, Paddy, just on that, like if you look at South Africa, I mean, we had Carl Du Plessis in 97 take over the Springboks. And I think he had maybe coached UCT or something. But like, to me, when I heard about this, I rolled my eyes and I thought, okay, this is going to be crash and burn and end of Gary Kirsten. But I mean, that's some context there, isn't it?
Yeah, listen, and we still look back and go, how the hell did they decide to pick Gary Kirsten? It doesn't make sense. And the people who did it would say it was a masterstroke. And I would say it's probably closer to random fluke. They'd had a foreign coach that was controversial, and maybe they looked around and said, well, let's pick a guy who's got a good name, good reputation, and never been involved in controversy. Mm-hmm. So Gary wasn't going to go in there and be controversial. Yep. You know, that's our best thinking, how they picked him. And my role was as mental conditioning coach and strategic leadership coach, which didn't exist. And I didn't even quite understand what that meant. Even now, I don't quite understand. But it was just like the two of us going to go and do the job. And the other thing that was really lucky is because we have got very clear ideas around coaching philosophy and the new way of coaching philosophy. We were very clear about that. And obviously, Gary has incredible cricket knowledge. But we didn't understand these players. We didn't know them. We South Africans, they're Indian. We didn't understand India and the Indian way and the Indianisms and how the North and South are different and East and West and how hierarchical it is and the different languages. And it is over a billion people and there's so much diversity. We didn't understand that.
If you did, so, would you have not taken it? Like if you knew what you know now?
Well, all I know now is I know a little bit more, but there's at least I know that there's so much that I don't know.
Yep, yep.
That's the whole thing about India is you'll never ever as a foreigner understand India. And if you think you do straight away, you're in trouble.
You're a novice. Yeah.
So I probably understand it two or three levels deeper than another foreigner, but that's about seven levels that I don't understand because it's India, it's different. So what that did is it forced Gary and I to go in there and to listen, to pay attention, to understand, because we didn't have the all-knowing to go and impose it on the team like the previous coach had. So by default, we were pushed into, and that's also natural for our coaching approach and our personalities, is to try and understand people. What do you want? What works? What's the stuff that doesn't work? Guide us to help you, as opposed to us thinking we're going to pitch here with these foreigners and we know what you guys need. So we spend so much time really listening, really asking questions, really paying attention. For the majority of the 3 years when Gary spoke or addressed the players, I watched Gary, I watched his body language, I watched the players, I gauged the energy, how's this message being received, and was constantly giving Gary feedback so that we could learn how to be as effective as possible. So in that way, it was fairly easy to not be egoic, because ego knows, and ego is the all-knowing. We knew we weren't the all-knowing, so don't even bother to try and think we're experts in this space, which caused us or forced us into using probably the most, one of the most valuable coaching tools that one can use, is your eyes and your ears and your seeking to understand.
Yeah. All right. So, and I mean, you were dealing with some of the best players in the world there, weren't you? I mean, Tendulkar was there, Dravid was there. There's a bunch of those guys.
Yeah.
Which of those players kind of just embrace it like, oh, thank goodness, like I'd love someone to listen to me. And you don't have to mention names, but was there a balance or over the duration leading up to the World Cup, did you find that some of those players who wanted to be told just kind of fell away and the team became full of players who wanted input into their own development?
You know, Indians are by nature very respectful. So we didn't have a whole lot of pushback. And if I were to actually go back to our first meeting on day one with the team in March 2008, Gary had gone and spent time with all the players on a tour before he was appointed. He went on the tour, he spent some time with the team, he had one-on-ones with every player. And one of the messages that came through was, what we want is direction. Because the previous coach had been fired. They had 6 months under caretaker coach when the team was really rudderless and had no direction. They said to Gary, we want some direction. So knowing that we weren't people who were going to go and impose a direction, but they had asked for it. So we were really cautious in coming up with, so this is our proposed way forward. And we made it really broad so it would include as many different personalities and learning styles as possible. And Gary presented it to the team, and we spent a lot of time making it really inclusive. We didn't, one of our mottos there was nothing to resist. We don't want to get players' backs up like the previous coach had done. So we presented it to the player. Well, Gary presented it to the players in 45 minutes, 1 hour, morning one, day one. And Gary said, at the end of it, he said, so what do you guys think? And all the players nodded their head or gave it the Indian head shake, and they said, yeah, that's great. And we didn't understand Indian head shake well enough at the time to know, is that yes or is that no? Yeah. But they said it was great and this was what they wanted. We broke for tea that morning, and Gary and I sat down. We both at the same time literally said the same thing. We said, oh shit, that didn't land. It's like there was something about the energy, but that yes, that's what we wanted. It didn't feel sincere, even though we didn't know what sincere felt like at the time because we didn't understand Indians. And Gary said, yes, that was my sense. I felt there was no real engagement when I was talking. And we did a 180 degree turn in our approach 1 hour into our 3 year assignments. And we went back into the room, and Gary handed over to me. And I said to the players, you've got a 51% win ratio in test cricket, a 30% win ratio in one day internationals. There's obviously a whole lot of stuff that is working. We broke them into groups and I said, write down all the things that are working in your head that's sort of 7 out of 10 or better. We want to know what's working. And also, because one of the reasons is we must make sure we don't change any of the things or throw any things out that's already working. And we want to know what's working with regards practice, with regards travel, with regards team talks, team meetings, on-field strategy, communication, etc., etc. Just brainstorm everything that you feel is working pretty nicely that we mustn't as foreigners come and mess around with. And we got a fairly exhaustive list. Over the lunchtime, we put that into some structure. And after lunch, Gary presented their exact words back to them and said, what do you feel about that in terms of the strategy going forward? And we got the proper, authentic two thumbs up, which is obvious in hindsight because we asked them what's really working that you want us to do. They told us and we gave it back to them. And they felt then, yes, this is our strategy and this feels like it's going to work. And that right up front, we realized, damn, we know theoretically we need to ask questions and provide what the players need. But there's a great example. We pitched as newbies with a strategy. It's like, it's bizarre. You can't do that. It doesn't work.
Yeah. When you say it like that, it just makes it so clear. Now, Paddy, we've got some questions. We've got one from TC. It says, thanks, Paddy. Great insights. I've often wondered how you transitioned your relationships with players and support staff when moving from fitness trainer to mental skills coach positions at South Africa, in South Africa?
Thanks very much for that question. I think that the first thing that comes to me is I was pretty lucky in that as a fitness trainer, when I came back as a mental coach, there was, I think, only three or four players from the fitness training team to the mental team. I finished in 98 and I came back a little bit later. So, and I think it's similar for a player moving from player to coach. If you go from a player and you come move straight away to coach and you come back to coach players you played with, I think it's a lot more difficult. So one, I had that gap. But as a fitness trainer, my natural default is to ask people what they want and then to provide them, to work with them, as opposed to arriving thinking I'm the all-knowing expert that I need to impose expertise on people. Because when people did that to me through my school and university and playing career, it got my back up. So I was just naturally allergic to people telling me what to do. And I certainly found fitness training is, and I still think fitness training and dietitian and probably physios are still the most prescriptive professions in sport. And I really didn't believe in prescribing to players what they need to do. And I often use the example of Hansie Cronje, who was one of the fittest cricketers, I think, in the last 40 years to play the game. And I would say to Hansie before a gym session, and he was already a fitness fanatic, I said, Hansie, just do a couple of push-ups to warm up your chest before we do some chest exercises. And he would say to me, how many push-ups? Okay, no, just do it until you feel you're warm, you know, and some days you don't need to do it, and some days you need to do two sets of 15. But Hansie was so conditioned to know, you tell me what to do and I'll do it. And I always struggled with that level, that the degree to which players really didn't understand their bodies. And I wanted players to understand their bodies, to know what worked for them, so that I could prescribe something that worked. Remember back in those days, there was no manual for S&C in professional cricket or most team sports. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to find what did players enjoy and then prescribe as much of what they enjoyed, because then I knew there would be uptake in fitness. You know, case in point, the two opening batsmen back then was Andrew Hudson and Gary Kirsten. Gary loved long distance running. Andrew Hudson hated it, but he loved shuttle running. So two guys in exactly the same position. When it came to training, Gary would do mostly distance and Andrew Hudson would do mostly shuttle. So I was used to, I guess, working with players' minds, because I needed to figure out what can I do that gets you to really take and do this training. So it was a fairly natural progression to working with the mental side of the game, because the mental side of the game is almost the glue that holds everything together. You know, there's another conversation about why, you know, and maybe we can jump into that. Why mental coaching or having a sports psychologist in a team pretty much doesn't work still today.
I'm really keen to explore that, because I've struggled in individual sports and team sports with that. So I'm very interested in your thoughts. Let's go down that tangent.
Okay, so I invite everyone to go through this thought exercise, and I know pity we can't engage, but number one, everyone says that the mind is probably the most important aspect of success, particularly at the highest level of the game. Mm-hmm. For some reason, we think there's this thumbsuck number that it's 80% of success is in the mind. I don't know where we get that from, but that's out there. So if the mind is so important, and then you have this group of people, sports psychologists, and to become a genuine registered sports psychologist, it's 7 years of university study. And these guys are the experts in this domain that's so important. Surely then the sports psychologist should be at least one of the most important members of any professional team support staff. If you just put those two together. And I ask you, can any one of you name three well-known sports psychologists who've done really good work in any team sport, any time in history? Can you just name three? I ask you, Grant, can you name me three well-known sports psychologists?
In Australia, in various programs, I probably could, but your point stands. If we're saying it's that important. Sorry, you just broke up for a second.
So there should theoretically be a sports psychologist in every certainly professional team if the mind is so important and these guys are the experts. So because there isn't, it means there's something wrong in that equation. Either we're wrong that the mind is so important, or the training that sports psychologists get is wrong. It's not meeting the need. Or our view of the model that you've got these players and the coach and a whole coaching staff, and then you bring this sports psychologist in to come and talk to the players. That model, and to me, that's one of the biggest problems. It's that model of the sports psychologist coming as an outsider to be part of the support staff to work with the players.
And certainly, sorry, if I could just interrupt you there. That person's often only brought in when something wrong is happening. So correct. Immediately I often say to my players, you don't come to me because you are very unfit and it's a problem. A lot of people come to me because they're at the top of their game and they just wanted to raise it one more step. I agree 100% there. Keep going.
So in team sport, the mental conditioner in a team sport is the culture. The culture in the team is the biggest influence on players' mind. I'll give you an example. If the coach or some senior players gesticulate when someone makes a mistake, shout, scream, throw their arms up in the air, I will show you a team that is filled with the fear of failure. If you have a coach that gets super excited about winning and gets really down when the team loses, you will find a team that is riddled with pressure to do well and pressure to not do badly. But if you have a coach and a senior leadership team who are pretty even keeled, they're not attached to results, they don't behave very differently around winning and losing, they just have good, mature learning conversations. If someone makes a mistake, the general feeling or the culture in the team is to rush to them and support them, because when an athlete makes a mistake, what they most need out of anyone in the world in that moment is support and love. Because we've all been through that. We know how terrible it feels. So if you've got a really healthy, supportive culture, you don't really need too much intervention from the sports psychologist. Maybe the odd individuals who's having their own individual problem, and very often it's related to their personal lives, yes, they need to chat to someone. So where the sports psychology has worked the best generally is when they are the coach's right-hand man or right-hand woman. Because the coach is the mental conditioner. Or I say the coach, it's wherever the sphere of influence is in the team. Because sometimes it's with a coach, sometimes it's with a senior player, sometimes it's coach and captain. So there's always a sphere or field of influence within a team. And if the sports psychologist is communicating and supporting them around how they're communicating, how they're behaving, and the result of their communication, their behavior on the culture of the team and on the player's mindset, that's when sports psychology really works the best. And I take a case in, I take India to go to a practical case in point. When I went to the Indian team with Gary, I was the mental conditioning coach. And I ended up having quite a lot of one-on-one conversations with quite a lot of players. Those players who were open and free enough to want to seek out mental conditioning, which you're quite right. It's always the guys at the top of their game and most confident within themselves. They sort it out. The most vulnerable guys who need it the most didn't. It's a funny thing that ego does there. The more I coached Gary and worked with Anil Kumble and then MS Dhoni around their body language, their communication, how does that line up with the kind of culture that we want to create that frees players from particularly fear and pressure to the biggest mental obstacles to success? So how are we creating an environment that reduces pressure and fear? And the more that culture took root, the less and the less players actually wanted one-on-one conversations with me. And I ended up in the second half of my 3-year tenure there, having very few one-on-one conversations. And when I did have a one-on-one mental conditioning conversation with somebody, we would go downstairs into the hotel foyer. And I would say more often than not, we would sit down, the player would say, this is the thing I want to talk about. We would order a cappuccino from the waiter. And before the waiter had got back, we'd concluded that conversation. But just a tiny little fine tune, because the culture is the thing that got the players into the right mindset. And to go, the command and control, and particularly the coach who stands up and shouts and screams, you need a sports psychologist in your team, because you'll have a players who are riddled with fear and pressure and fear of failure. And it's because of the way
we... It's just simple, basic stuff. Like if I'm a coach, I like to lead from the front in many ways. So if I'm performing on the side of the tennis court, on the side of the BMX track or the footy field, and I'm yelling at the referees and the officials and stuff like that, I can't ask my players to have a calm, cool, collected head on the field, on the tennis court, in the BMX. And so when I look at that, and yet, you know, if you look at the sort of Friday night football, or if you look at the typical Hollywood coach, what you're saying and what we are presented in the media the whole time, you know, it's just a massive disconnect, isn't it?
You know, that coach that runs up and down, I think football is a great example. You watch the coach run up and down and gesticulating and screaming and shouting. I know water polo coaches are particularly guilty of that. And I ask the players, you know, do you hear your coach? And they'll go, no. I'm just aware there's all this noise and movement going on, but I can't actually hear what he's doing. He's just behaving like a clown in the background. A player, an honest player will tell you, he's just behaving like an idiot. And I'm being really honest because I speak to players. What's your experience when your coach behaves like that? And it's like, come on, dude, like adults don't behave like that. But it's good theater, but it's not very effective.
100%. Now, we've got another question from Sophie. Hi, Paddy. Going back a little bit, can you talk a bit more about how you've approached head coaches who view the fitness as a punishment? I've found I've often had to battle with head coaches wanting to really smash players during conditioning as punishment for mistakes, poor performance, effort, all that kind of stuff. So what's your strategy to try to change the way they perceive fitness and punishments?
Wow. First answer is education. And very often, ego stands in the way of education. So again, there's a whole continuum, but if I were to paint the two sides of the continuum, on one side is the coach who's secure enough with him or herself to know what they know and know what they don't know, and then to get good people in to bring the stuff that they don't know. And then the other end, you get the coach who is often very egoic. They know a lot about the technical, tactical, strategic side of the sport and are very threatened by people who know stuff about the sport that they don't know, like fitness, like diet, and like the mental side of the game. Those coaches close the door and they make it difficult for other people to come in and metaphorically stand in front of the room and present a level of expertise that the coach doesn't have. And it's very difficult as a strength and conditioning coach, mental conditioning coach, to be pulled into a team where the coach doesn't buy into that approach or that modality in their team. And that's just damn difficult. So the best way to preserve your career and to be successful, but it's very difficult, is to team up with coaches and teams that value what you do. But it is very difficult. I understand, you know, if I were to go back to, you know, my early days of mental coaching, and I would be pulled into an environment where it was somebody in the board wanted me to come in, but the coach didn't really buy in. It never worked. I never got decent traction. And if you ask players in those teams, they would say, yes, we tried sports psychology, but it didn't work. Or Paddy wasn't good because there wasn't buy-in. Where if I were to take a different step, when I got my first role as head coach in T20 cricket, which was in the IPL in 2013, I never, like Gary Kirsten, I'd never been a head coach. But unlike Gary, I never played enough cricket to actually warrant that being granted that position. I only got that position because Rahul Dravid, who was a highly respected cricketer within Indian cricket and within the Rajasthan Royals team, and Rahul said, I buy into Paddy's approach. I want him here. And when I managed to get through the interview panel, Rahul had literally presented to the team that I buy into what Paddy does, so I want you guys to listen to him. So I already had a champion when I stepped into that role. So it was set up for success. So as an SNC coach, ideally you want to somehow create a situation where the coach buys into what you're doing and makes you a champion and makes what you do a champion, then it works. If the coach doesn't do it, then you need to find a way to somehow educate or bring them around to get somebody who the coach really listens to bring them around to accepting the idea that fitness is important, the way we do it's important, and that understand why prescribing it as punishment is really counterproductive. Mm-hmm. I think that's why so many people don't continue doing exercise after school or after playing sport, is because they do associate it with punishment, which is such a flippin' yesterday approach to fitness. And I guess maybe now that we, you know, I grew up when there's corporal punishment, so good whack worked. You didn't have to run around the field, they just whacked you with a cane. But really, coaches who prescribe exercise as punishment, they themselves should be whacked with a cane or prescribe exercise as punishment. What it feels like.
Now, Paddy, we've got a few more questions coming through, but I want to just talk about, you brought up your first case as a head coach, where I'm guessing with India, Gary would have most of the time been front and center for any loss or barbs or whatever. What was that transition like to suddenly being front and center yourself? And then what did you find that you were learning as you were going along?
You know, I learned so much from Gary, from watching Gary as a head coach and making it about the players and deferring back to the players. So for me, that was very clear. That's what I needed to do. And again, I was lucky, as I said, that I didn't arrive with enough expertise to get sucked into the trap of standing in front of the room and being the expert. So when I stood in front of the team from day one, in my head was, I don't need to have the answers, but what I do need to do is be really smart in surfacing the best possible answer to whatever the problem or the situation is we're talking about. So I found that very easy. You know, and I've got some really good friends who know that I don't know enough about cricket to actually be occupying that room in the front of the room, that space in front of the room, compared to the experts out there, or the technical, tactical, strategic experts. And they say to me, Paddy, what's it like? So for example, in the Big Bash League in Australia, I coached a team that had Owen Morgan, Mike Hussey, and Jacques Cullis in one team. And they said, what is it like coaching these guys where you have a bad game, you come into the room afterwards, and now you need to tell these guys, these legends of the game, what they did wrong, and you need to analyze the game. How do you actually do it? Isn't that a whole lot of pressure on you leading up to that meeting? And my answer is no. I walk into that meeting with no pressure whatsoever, other than to come up with the really good questions that allow the answers to surface. And because I've got Mike Hussey and Jacques Cullis and Owen Morgan in the room, the chance of the best answer emerging is very, very good. So I just need to move myself out the way because the answer sits in the room anyway.
Yeah. All right.
Not sure that answer.
Let's go through that. You've just been thumped, or it was a bad loss because you should have won, or whatever the case is. The players file into the room. Give us an idea of some of the leading questions that you might ask that gets you out of the way and gets the best answers to come through.
Okay, so the first one is a statement of fact, is that guys, we went into that game with good plans to want to win, and we know that we let ourselves down in some areas. Statement of fact. Then what I would do in T20 cricket, for example, is if I were just to contrast what normally happens, is the coach will stand up and they will have gone through so much information with the video analyst, and they will have come up with all those key moments of the games where things went right or things went wrong. And very often the coach will present that data, those statistics, and the video to support it. And the players sit and they get this show coming back at them from the front of the room. I turn that on its head and I just write, I've been through all that. I've done all that, had all that conversation with the analyst. I will just write in a flip chart in T20 cricket, the first 6 overs of the first innings, which is the power play. So that's a phase of play. And then sort of over 7 to 15 is the next middle phase. And then the last 5 overs, say, is a death phase. And I will just write up overs 1 to 6, 40 for 2. Just the statistic at the end of that. My question then to the team is, right, if we hit it for 2 and we're batting, that means 4 people batted. 2 are out and 2 are not out at the end of that. What was your experience of that 6 overs? That's the question.
Yep.
And the players talk about what their experience was.
An open-ended question. Like, you're not even really guarding it that much. You're just opening the floor.
So we've already set it up that when somebody makes a mistake, and this takes a little bit of a while, when somebody makes a mistake, number one, we all know it's obvious. It's on the video. It's in the stats. What I coach players in generally 101 is, first of all, mistakes are to be expected. They're guaranteed, and therefore they're okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much on mistakes are okay. There's no judgment going with them. If you do something really well, if you do something really badly, what I'm interested in is what is the learning. So players know, if I made a mistake, it's okay. So first thing what I do is I own up. Guys, I felt we were behind the run rate, and I thought if I ran down the wicket and hit a 6, it would relieve us. That was my mistake. I got out and I put pressure on the team. My mistake, I'm sorry. Number one, so own it. Number two, the question would be, so if you had that situation over again next time, based on what you learned, what would you do differently? And the player would then tell what he would do differently. So once that's introduced into a team and I go, so what was your experience of the first 6 overs? Where a player makes a mistake, he'll put his hand up and he said, this is what I got wrong. We know that. I'm not that interested in what you got wrong. There's no value in that. The value is, what was your thinking that led to you getting that wrong? And the player will then say, this is what I was thinking. In hindsight, that wasn't good thinking. And next time I'm in that situation, this is what I would do differently. That's all. Very often that's sufficient. There's a sense of ownership of the player. And I'll just jump in here. Early on, there are a few players who secure enough within themselves to be able to put their hand up in a team meeting and own a mistake. I find those players as quickly as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have the conversation after the game. They will talk about their mistake. I will ask them, so if you had that over again, what would you do differently? And they tell me, and we have a coaching conversation around what they would probably do differently next time, having learned from made a mistake. Then I will say to them, won't you please do me a favor? In the team meeting, won't you please share that? Would you be comfortable sharing that with the rest of the players?
Mm-hmm.
And a secure player will say, yes, happy. So I will actually tee it up, let that player have the conversation in front of the team and really acknowledge and ask if any other players got, you know, had a similar experience. So that was a long story. The best possible space for me that I know when a player can put his hand up and say, this is what I did wrong. This was my thinking that led to that. And next time, what I've learned is this, what I would do differently.
Mm-hmm.
When we've got to that space, our team is in an unbelievable space and they're ready to do the entire debrief all by themselves. So to go back to that 1 to 6 overs, I'll ask, guys, what's your experience the first 6 overs? the players who are batting out there, or if we are fielding, they talk, the bowlers will talk and the captain will talk about their experience, that they see what we did wrong and what we could do better. And then before moving on from that, then I'd ask the rest of the players, guys, from where you were standing, or maybe even the guys who are sitting on the bench, the reserves, how did you see it from where you were sitting? Have the conversation. And we sit in a circle and I'm clear, guys, talk to each other. Don't talk to me. And I get players having conversations around what they saw and what their experience, and they start asking questions. And what happens, you get all this intelligence lands in the middle of the circle, and then we can really start learning from the best thinking that lands in the circle. And that's how it would go through it. And similarly, when we are preparing strategy-wise for a game, I've got the stats. If we're bowling, for example, against AB de Villiers in the IPL, I've got all the stats and all the data and all the video on AB de Villiers. It's all available. But I also know all of these players have sat in meetings in their various teams around the world, and they've discussed bowling to AB de Villiers. They've all sat and watched him bat. They've all played against him or with him. So I'll say to the players, guys, what is your best thinking around how we get AB out, how we keep AB quiet? Given the fact, given these bowlers in this room and the fielders in this room, what's our best chance? And they come up with an idea.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and if they come up with an idea, they've got the best possible chance of remembering it under pressure. If I impose it on the players that are under pressure, almost guaranteed they'll forget and they'll just default to their natural thinking anyway.
That's an interesting point there, though. To, you know, if you externally impose it, they default to themselves. But got a, like a bit of a sticky question there then. So what happens to the player fourth time in a row? He's done, he's gone for the six because he felt under pressure and he's kind of defaulted to that. How do you change that behavior?
Well, now we have a conversation. Then we say, okay, so it seems like it's, this has happened four times. This has been your understanding. This is what you've said each time. Is there... ask the player, so what do you see in that? What is your reflection when you see you've done the same thing four times around, you have the same explanation? It would seem that there's something we haven't mined down to the that place in their mind where that change in behavior is driven. We haven't gone to the depth deep enough. So it just gives an opportunity to have another conversation around that meta process, for want of a better word. Okay. Because very often a player's understanding of what they did wrong the first time, it's very incomplete. It's just their best understanding. And very often it's they won't tell me as the coach or the team the real answer for fear of the judgment. Mm-hmm. So as I said, most mental pressure, most mental obstacles in sport is pressure and fear. Is a player in front of his teammates going to be happy to say, I was scared? Or I succumb to the pressure? Generally not. There's a bit of a fear of the judgments of doing that, even though everyone in the room makes their mistakes for those same reasons. But they all sit there hiding the same stuff from each other, and they all know they're all hiding it from each other. So the skill then of a coach or a mental conditioning coach is how do we take that conversation that's there going on in all of their heads all at the same time and bring that actually into the room? Yep. And, you know, there's some cool ways to do that.
So, Paddy, I'm just aware of time here. We still got some questions from Justin, and TC's got another follow-up one, I see. It sounds like when you are looking at a job opportunity, you're going to be interviewing, as you know, the board, the decision makers, the owners of the team, and see which kind of players are there. In the head coach role, what are you looking for from your support staff, your S&C, your whatever structure you actually, could you expand? What structure do you look for? And then how does someone get onto one of your teams? Support staff.
So the reality is, again, there's a spectrum of things that can happen. I've been brought into teams where I'm brought in as the head coach and I inherit the existing support staff. So the one head coach has left and I just come in and sit in that seat. And further to the other end is when you're creating a new team, for example, or the entire support staff has been let go and I get to choose the majority of the support staff. And we all find ourselves in a range somewhere along that continuum. It's complex. Maybe some of the things that come to mind is some of the problems on this end of the continuum where we get to choose our own S&C and our support staff, some of the problems that I've seen, and the most obvious problem is I choose the person who I like. And very often people that we like are people who are similar to us and agree with us and we're on the same page. Unless you've got a real deep understanding of coaching and of people and of teams and a real emotional intelligence, then that can work. So Gary Kirsten and I, for example,
we are you like similar personalities? I don't know, Gary. Are you similar personalities?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, we're quite different.
Okay.
So there is a danger in picking people that we like and that we're comfortable with. It's ideal if you pick somebody, and for me, it's so I like to be creative. I like to be spontaneous, innovative. I'm an ideas person. So I like to have somebody who's really structured and really organized, so we can balance each other out. So one, I need someone who's complements me in my areas of weakness. I need that person to be comfortable enough within themselves to challenge me, not from a level of ego, but from a level of helping the two of us be more effective and helping me learn. For me, it's really important that that person has high levels of emotional intelligence. I think that's critical in being in any support staff role. And the other thing is I need that person. And for me, the really important thing has been that they understand my philosophy that we want the intelligence to come from the players, which means arrive at the meeting having done all your preparation in whatever way that you would normally prepare. But the players are going to speak first, and we're going to allow the players to have the conversation. Only once the players have finished talking about that particular subject, then can we as coaches step in and fill in any gaps. So for me, those are the important things. Is emotionally intelligent, complement my weaknesses. They need to challenge me and be comfortable to challenge me, and I need to buy into the same philosophy.
And be comfortable enough to be challenged, I'm guessing. Like you're going to be asking them or pushing back to understand their what. You know, I think Simon Sinek says, know your why. Why are you doing that? Why are you?
Yes.
All right. I've got a quick question. What would you tell a young Paddy Upton?
I would tell a young Paddy Upton, go and understand yourself, your motivators, your drivers, understand your why, understand your purpose, understand your philosophy. Go on a journey of self-discovery and self-mastery is probably more important than having a knowledge of the game. And I only, as a blokey bloke, sport playing, beer swilling, South African male, it was only sort of late in my 20s, early 30s that I really started to ask those deeper questions in life. And it's that journey that has probably contributed most to my success in any profession, knowing who I am, than knowing what I know or the experience or the degrees that I've got behind me. Where up until that sort of late 20s, for me, it was about accumulating knowledge and accumulating degrees, thinking, well, that's where my strength lies. But that was getting stuff out there. I would say to the young Paddy, go inwards, because that's where the great coaches, the great leaders are because of who they are inside, not because of what they got in their prefrontal cortex.
I think Sun Tzu says, know thyself. I've got a question here from Justin. And then, guys, after Paddy's asked Justin's question, feel free to turn mics off and you can ask directly. But this is from Justin. Paddy, backtracking slightly. When you exited the world of sport to go traveling, did you consider leaving for good? What pushed you to go back? And how did you restart those conversations to get the opportunity back in sport after traveling abroad?
So when I went, it wasn't with any plan other than to be at least traveling for 6 months. For me, I've changed professions maybe five times in my life. S&C, mental coaching, head coaching, business coach, and street worker. And what I found after each one, so I'm comfortable stepping into the unknown, but I found after leaving each one of those, I needed a period to decompress, to really get to places sort of hollow and empty and a place of stillness, having got rid of, like let go of the past, to really then let the next, what's next come in. And it's almost like a relationship. If you're in a 2-year relationship with a partner and you break up, if you jump into the next relationship the next week, it's probably not going to last and you've got too much stuff, mess spilling over from one into the other. So to create the gap and the distance to allow the one to end and the next one to come in is, to me, has been, you know, probably the most important thing. So, and that's really what I did. It was intuitive doing it then. I didn't know I'm going to walk away, allow myself to really clear that so that I can be thinking clearly about allowing the new path to emerge. It just happened that way. And I look back and I go, okay, so that's why it worked, as opposed to jumping straight from one into the next.
Yeah, great answer. I'd never thought of it like that. That's awesome. All righty, team. Mic's off mute and feel free to fire away. We've got John. So, Patty, John is the first one to always ask a question. He's got the trigger finger. All right, shoot, John.
Hi, Patty. How's it going? You hear sometimes coming out of media and the camp and professional sporting camps where if you haven't played at a certain level, then the coaches, the players have the opinion of you haven't been here, you don't know what it's like. Have you encountered that before? And how do you get the buy-in from people who are in that situation?
Okay, that's a great question. So the old school way of thinking is you need to have been there in order to do it. And it's easier then to actually step into the coaching role if you've been there and done it before. But the distinction for me and that's really important is there's knowledge of the game and knowledge of coaching are two fundamentally different things. And people with just knowledge of the game stepping into a coaching role, the only way they can convey their knowledge of the game is by telling other people what to do. So being an instructor, where someone who doesn't have knowledge of the game and only has knowledge of coaching, they would then use a much more empowering modern day servant leadership, harness the collective intelligence of the group approach. But the problem with that is maybe they don't have the credibility, that person doesn't have the credibility with the players. Like myself, for example, who never played cricket at the highest level of the game, and yet I'm coaching guys who are at the highest level of the game. And for me, as I mentioned earlier, the way that I got around that is when I stepped into my first head coaching role, I had Rahul Dravid, a legend of the game, saying, I endorse this guy and this guy's approach. So if you haven't been there and done it, you do need a champion in the system who's been there and done it, who has the ears of particularly the senior players. That makes sense.
Awesome. TC, I noticed you've... you ready to go?
Yep, thanks, Grant. G'day, Patty. Great hearing your insights. Really enjoyed that. Probably the question I have for you, going on with a few things you've already said, is now that you've obviously worked as a head coach for quite a while now and you've had support staff in different environments in different countries, how do you go about sort of integrating that group, knowing how close those groups have to work in short spaces of time? What is your process with kind of creating an atmosphere where, as you say, you sometimes have to go in with staff that have kind of been thrust upon you, you don't get to choose them. Do you have a way that you go about kind of making that process easier?
So I think I understand your question is, so how do I integrate staff that I don't necessarily know and players who come from all over the world into a team where you've got a very short space of time to create a team? So my approach is, again, sort of the top line for me is I need to harness the best thinking of this group is one approach. I know a lot of other coaches who coach in the same leagues, they arrive with the best thinking and they impose it on the group. So the way I would do that is I would get the coaching staff together and have a coaching conversation. Guys, you've all coached in different teams. You've coached in this team. You've coached around the world. What is the best thinking when it comes to, and we'll talk about practicing, we'll talk about pre-game strategy meetings, post-game debriefs, managing players, how, and we talk about what is our, the best knowledge that sits with this group, and we'd have a learning conversation. And from that, we get to understand each other's philosophies, we get to understand each other, and then we start talking about, well, how do we pull the best of that thinking and experience and create a unified approach within this team? So there is a harnessing intelligence, and then there's a collective buy-in and construction of how we're going to work together. And I'll do the similar thing with the players. I sit down with the players and I'll say to them, guys, so let's look at something like, for example, in cricket is selection. It's a very subjective process, and there's a lot of problems around selection. So I'll say to players, how have you guys selected before? Do you rely on the selectors to do it? Do you have just coach and captain, or do you have a few senior players? How can we best navigate the process of selecting players here? And people who don't play, what are the problems when it comes to mentioning to them or telling them they're not playing? And let's make sure we don't fall into any of those traps. What is the best way of doing it? And in that way, everyone gets to be heard. We get to actually hear the best of what's out there. As a coach, it's flipping amazing to sit there and listen. I listen to 25 different players talk about the best things that they experience their coach is doing. That fast tracks my learning. In 1 hour, I learn what the best coaches in the world, or these players, the best coaches they've ever played under, do. So it's a harnessing the collective intelligence and collaborating and having a conversation of how do we now put this together in a way that's best going to work for us. And so that's one thing. And the other thing that I'll establish right up front is say, guys, what do you want to get out of this period of time together? And you can do it in any team, down to another 9 school team. What do you want to get out of this season? And to really listen to what players want to get out of it, and then come up with the 2 or 3 most important things. And it's almost always something around having fun, something about learning, and something about winning. Something around those 3 things normally. Okay, so how do we make sure that everything we do moves us in the direction of learning as much as we can, having as much fun, and at the same time, putting the score on the scoreboard? And everything we do then, make sure it ticks the criteria of those boxes. And the one thing that actually deviates, the one thing that deviates teams most from that is the coach imposing their way and their will on the players, which generally is, as I said, that's the ego thing, and that's the derailer of most good effective coaching.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for your question, TC. So I think Rob McCafferty, he's got a question for you, Paddy.
Hey, Paddy. I just wanted to sort of touch on that player-driven approach that you talked about with the squads that you've worked in. I sort of work with sort of youth teams, so probably around 16, 17-year-olds at that sort of schoolboy level. I like the sort of the idea behind it, but do you think there's like a certain level of experience you need to apply that player-driven approach?
Okay, great question, and the answer is no. There is no particular experience or knowledge level, but I talk about an ice cream cone. At under 9 level, you need to be giving the players a little bit of responsibility for making a few fairly inconsequential decisions for themselves. Then at under 10 level, you want to give them a bit more responsibility. And so as they move up, you just keep giving them a little bit more and more responsibility. And if you do that within a system, within a club or within a school, what you get by the senior age groups, you will have the most intelligent team of anyone in your league guaranteed. The challenge is if you're coaching under 16 and you're not responsible for what happens in under 15, 14, 13, you need to then at least start them. And what I say is give them 5% more responsibility for making decisions than what they've had last year. So ascertain where they're at and just give them a little bit more. And a practical example that I use is they're probably used to the coach telling, structuring what's going to happen at every practice. Sometimes we have this Friday practice or captain's practice or something like that. So then what I would suggest is, let's say on a Tuesday practice, where they're used to being arriving and being waiting to be told what to do. I would go to a couple of senior players the week before and say, listen, on next Tuesday's practice, the last half an hour, I want you to go talk amongst the players and come back and tell me what you think will be the best use of that half an hour. And this is assuming now, this is where it's useful to know what does the team want to get out of the season. So what will, and if I use my examples, if we want to have fun, we want to learn and we want to win. So what can we do in that half an hour that will be even more fun, even more learning, or you think will take us, give us even a slightly better chance of winning? And they then come to you and say, this is what we think we should do. So you're actually giving them, you're asking them to think about what they want to do at practice. If another example, after in the pre-game strategy, if they're used to the coach doing all the talking, you want them to do at least a little bit of talking. So what are the safe areas, for example? And the safe area in any environment is, if you're playing a home game, say to the players, what are the things that we know about playing at this venue that the other guys don't? But I need to know the detail that make it give us a little bit more advantage playing at home than the other guys. And I ask the players to talk about it. Because the reality is they actually do know. Or maybe if you're going to play away, say to the guys, who's played at this venue before? What can you tell us about playing at that venue that's useful for us to consider in our strategy? They already do have that knowledge. And instead of you telling them, I get the players to do that. So just, it's just to find out where can the players be talking 5% more in a meeting or making 5% more decisions about what they do than what they did last week or yesterday. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Paddy, that's awesome. Thanks, man. That's really good.
And I just want to flag it. If you go from a team that's been very instruction-based, or maybe you've been very instruction-based and go, oh, I've heard about this player-centered approach where you guys take responsibility. So now I'm going to step back and you guys figure it all out. And that's like a 50% jump from what they used to. That creates a whole lot of anxiety. And I've actually got that wrong in a team that I've worked with before. In one of these professional T20 teams where I assumed the guys had more autonomy than what they actually did, I went in and gave them too much autonomy to run the team and they really couldn't handle it. It was actually too much of a stress. So I needed to go back and be a bit more prescriptive, figure out where are you at, and then just pace them by a little bit.
That's a great answer, Paddy. And I'm guessing when you look at coaching courses, you've got to look at it through a lens of frustration. Your typical level one, level two cricket course or strength and conditioning or whatever.
I have had a little pet project, Grant. Honestly, as I've traveled the cricket world and I've done quite a bit of work in rugby, I've asked players turn coaches who've done the level three, which qualifies them certainly in South Africa, mostly in cricket in South Africa and in the cricket world, to coach at state or provincial level. And I've asked them all the same question. Having now completed level three, is there anything new that you learned and equipped you to better coach now having done it than what you went into that level three? 100% of the time, it's like, no, I've learned nothing new. It was just a big fat tick the box exercise, but I've got the piece of paper that my boss is now going to say, ah, Grant can coach now. Yes, you can come for the interview because you've got this useless piece of paper.
Yeah.
So that's being very harsh. Most things in sport coaching accreditations now, if you were to just Google anything in that that's presented in that course, it will come up on the first page of an internet search. And if it comes up on the first page of an internet search, there is no value in teaching it in a structured course.
100%.
So yes, they frustrate me. And it does not qualify coaches to coach. It qualifies them to understand the game better, because most coaching courses, again, remember I said there's knowledge of the game, yep, knowledge of coaching. Yep. Most coaching courses still talk knowledge of the game, which ex-players have already got. It's the knowledge of helping other people learn where they don't have much experience.
Yeah, no, 100%. Now, I've missed a question from T-Josh. Is that how we pronounce it? T-Josh?
Yeah, exactly. T-Josh.
Do you want to ask Paddy? Sorry, I missed his question, but I see your mic's off. So can you ask Paddy your question?
Hi, Paddy. So I come from a rehab point of view, and I was wondering, like, how do you approach players that are returning from injuries or in bad form? Like, is there any, like, analysis or assessment you have with them before they return to play?
Yes, so thanks for that question. For me, there's two sort of really big areas to look at. The obvious one is the physical condition of that individual's ligaments or joints or muscles or bones or whatever it is that needs rehabbing to a level where they are ready to play and they're injury free. That's the thing that gets about 95% of the attention. What we miss out is what is that individual's psychological journey been from the time of injury? They almost always will go through a range of emotions, a couple of ups and downs. Most of them will go through then a dip of very often to some level of depression, even temporary depression, lost anxiety, and then they will slowly turn the corner and be able to refocus and move back towards the upward physical and psychological path towards returning to sport. And that journey is very up and down. It's very different for different individuals. But it's so important to help an individual understand where are you at mentally, where have you been, where do we need to get you, and what are the mental blocks that you see between where you were pre-injury and where you are now? What is new in your psyche that we need to work with? Because very often, more often than not, the player is physically ready to get back when we do all the measurements in the gym and in the laboratory. That muscle is back to as strong as it was. But psychologically, they're not ready. They're scared to go back in and take that big hit or whatever it might be. So in rehab, the psychological component is as important as the physical component. And you don't need to be a qualified psychologist to be able to help somebody with that. Just simply go and do a little bit of homework and research around the trauma cycle that people go through post-death. The post-death or the post-divorce trauma cycle is the same as the post-injury trauma cycle. And you'll find so much valuable information just to understand the kind of things that happened to players and the kind of mindsets. And there's about six or seven emotions. Kubler-Ross has got sort of, I think he's got five, and there's a couple of other people who've got six or seven different emotions that people go through. Go and understand that. Have those conversations. Get the player to go and read it. You know, those trauma cycle, those stages, and get the player to say, I identify with that and this didn't happen to me, but that's not really my style, but I fell into depression. And yes, you know, it starts with denial, you know, and blaming somebody else, and then frustration, and then anger, and then depression, and then hope, and then coming back. And get players to identify where they're at and have conversations with them around that. And what, you know, have conversations around what are you worried about when you get back? Because you can see here on the testing device that your muscle is 100% ready. Do you fully buy into and believe that you are 100% ready in rugby, that you're actually going to put your body on the line and take that same tackle that caused the injury in the first place? And get the player just to talk about it. You don't have to counsel them, because we don't need to be counselors these days. You get them to read this stuff and to come to you and identify where they're at and where they think they need to get to. And if it's a real problem, send them off to a sports psychologist. But you know what? I reckon, and this is controversial, but 4 out of 5 times, just getting them to engage with that material, have conversations with you, that is sufficient to help them navigate the mental journey. Because the physical journey is very, very easy. We can measure it and know how many weights to lift up and how to pace them back into getting fit. That's the easy part of rehab. But you ask an athlete what the most difficult part is, and they'll almost all tell you, it's what goes on here.
Yeah.
And getting out of the depression that they spend a fair bit of time in, especially in those long-term injuries.
Yeah, 100%. Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for your question, Tejas. Paddy, just thank you so much for your time. I know today's been a tough day, but I really appreciate those insights. I've written a whole page worth of notes. Yeah, just want to thank you. Again, anyone listening, follow Paddy on social media, Paddy Upton 1, just the number 1. Yeah, thank you again, and get through this tough time, and well, hopefully we'll stay connected.
Awesome. Thank you very much for the invitation. Really enjoyed spending the time, and thanks for you guys who gave up your an hour and a half of your day or evening to come and sort of listen in to us talk some shop. It's been awesome. I would love talking coaching.
Lekker, man. All right. Cheers, guys. Catch you later.
Ciao.